This is a People First Radio podcast.
Did you know in Alberta, youth caught up in the criminal justice system can be sentenced to learn about chess? Chess for Life is a restorative justice program at the University of Lethbridge that sees youth spend 25 hours studying the game and hopefully taking away lessons they can apply beyond the black and white world of the chessboard. Jade Oldfield works with the program. Why chess as a way to help young people who are entering the criminal justice system?
Great question. And that's generally the question we get asked. So there is some research to suggest that chess can be an effective intervention for youth in general. So not just youth in the criminal justice system, but youth in general. But in particular, my research is focusing on executive functions. And what we are suggesting and what we are hypothesizing is that chess as a cognitively demanding game, and based on the critical thinking involved in the game, is actually something that we can use to develop and grow, in particular, adolescent executive functions. So those are those skills like inhibition, right? Looking before you leap, thinking about the consequences of your action, things like working memory, right? Thinking about a couple moves ahead, holding those things in mind and manipulating them, as well as cognitive flexibility, right? The idea that, well, if this person moves here on the board, I can do this, but if they move here, then I have to respond this way. So all of those skills are actually very much used in the game of chess. And we know that executive functions are actually a better predictor of life success and life outcomes than even academic achievement. So we really are looking at essentially testing this, but the program itself's been around for a few years and we've seen that success already, but we've seen it anecdotally. We've heard it anecdotally. And so really we know that it's effective. Now we're just trying to prove that it's effective.
And the way the program works is over the course of 25 hours split up into a couple of hours each week, students will come and they will learn how the game of chess works. If they don't already know, they'll play games with some volunteers from the program. There will be maybe puzzles or workshops. Can you tell me a little bit about the journey that each individual participant goes on with the game of chess itself?
Absolutely. So as you've already mentioned, participants come to us with a variety of skill levels. Many come with little to no chess background, and some come with a relatively strong understanding of how the game works. So we've developed a bit of a curriculum that allows us to essentially take them from wherever they're at, and from there, we either review or teach the fundamental principles of the game. So, you know, not so much opening moves and patterns, but we teach them opening principles, right? We talk about why is it important to control the center of the board and other ideas that are kind of key to the game of chess. Now, some of them, that might be something that they're already aware of, but throughout their time with us, we also spend time taking those concepts and connecting them to real life. So it's not just about chess, it's about how do the activities, movements, things that happen over the board also apply to real life. As I was mentioning earlier with executive functioning, when we think about inhibition and looking before we leap, we can all find a time, probably every day, where we act a little impulsively. And so when we're going through these concepts with the kids, we're talking about, you know, things like space, time, and harmony. How do we use the space on the board effectively? And how do we use the space in our lives effectively, right? Like how do, you know, especially for teenagers, what does your room look like right now? Is that an effective use of space? Can you find what you're looking for in a moment's notice? Time, right? Especially as a teenager, youth don't necessarily have all of these concepts really ingrained. And so talking about how we can use our time effectively and productively, and then harmony. How does everything on the board and how do all the people and pieces in life work together in harmony to achieve a shared goal? So essentially, we take everyone where they're at. And then those that might have a little bit more experience, we try to lean on them a little bit too and pair them with other participants that might have a little bit less experience and give them that opportunity to have a bit of a leadership role during the program as well.
You mentioned that the program has been going on for a number of years and that anecdotally, a lot of people have done it and have had a great time and have made improvements, taken strides towards achieving what the point of the alternative sentencing measure was. And then you mentioned now it's time to study this in a less anecdotal way. How do you do that?
Absolutely. So the research is actually quite a bit of fun in the sense that the tests that we use really do resemble games in a lot of ways. So from the scientific perspective, we refer to them as most of them as psychometric tests. So if anyone's familiar with something like the Stroop task, that is where a word is flashed in front of the participant and it's a color word. So blue, yellow, red, something to that extent, depending on the version. Now, the trick to this activity is that the words are actually colored in a certain type of ink. So the word might read blue, but the word is actually colored in red. And so the participant actually needs to then select the color of the ink, not the what the word reads, essentially. So you have to inhibit one response in favor of another. So there's about 5 psychometric tests that we do that are looking at one or many of those executive functions I mentioned. There's a survey that they complete that they kind of self-assess their own executive functions. And then we also conduct a couple of Lego motor tasks. So the Lego motor tasks are designed to essentially look at the participant's use of space and then look at the use of their handedness. So if they are building more with their right or their left hand relative to where the pieces are in front of them. And so that testing is still a little bit, not tentative, but we're still digging into what that could tell us. But what we've seen from previous testing is that generally speaking, those that use their right hand more in those tasks tend to have better executive functioning skills. So we're going to be kind of looking at whether or not that holds true for these participants as well.
As a left-handed person, I need to ask, does that depend on whether a person is right or left-handed?
It doesn't seem to. So it does seem that just right-handed use seems to be more correlated. However, going off on a little bit of a side note, is what we see is that, generally speaking, people who are left-handed, the brain is organized slightly differently than those that are right-handed. So things like the language centers are in slightly different spots. And so that in and of itself, that reorganization in a different way might have an impact on how executive functions are expressed in what we call the prefrontal cortex, which is the last area of the brain in the front of your forehead to develop. And so that may be why there's that correlation a little bit between left-handed use in executive functions. But unfortunately, you are one of those rare few that are left-handed. So we don't always get enough of a sample of those people to really be able to look at why or how the base level is for those that are left-handed.
Now, returning to chess for life, students coming into this, or I should say participants coming into this, youth coming into this, what is the buy-in level like for them?
Absolutely. It does vary. And the nice thing about the program is that though they're referred to us through a probation officer, they do have the opportunity to try the program and say, you know what, this really isn't for me. So essentially what that means is that they may come to us, they may serve, you know, they might serve, you know, let's say 4 hours of community service hours, so a couple of weeks, and go, you know, this isn't for me. And that's completely fine. But generally speaking, most of the youth that are referred to us tend to stick around for a variety of reasons. One being that of all the community service hours or all the opportunities to serve community service hours that they have, you know, we provide them with a safe environment that's welcoming. They have access to food. They get to engage with mentors and university students where they can essentially just come to learn something. So there's a variety of reasons why they stay, but we do try to provide all the opportunities and remove all the barriers so that when they do get here, it's a safe and welcoming environment that they do feel comfortable not only just being in, but actually engaging in.
To what degree are you able to separate the positive benefits that might come from being in a welcoming group environment where there's pizza and snacks and people are generally having fun to specifically the elements that come from chess and how this might be different if everyone was gathered together playing bingo or something every week?
That's a wonderful question. And there's going to have to be a little bit more research done to be able to accurately answer that question. For example, realistically, we would have to conduct the same kind of research with a group that's playing checkers, right? Because like you just pointed out, you know, is it the social environment of, you know, being able to interact and play a game, or is it the cognitively demanding environment that, you know, chess essentially requires in order to be successful at the game? And that's the other thing is like, do you even have to be successful to experience the benefits, or is it just the environment? So what we're hoping to do is kind of further develop the study so that we can also collect not only the data that I've talked about previously with those tests, but also conduct some interviews and surveys to elicit a little bit more of the participants' thoughts and experiences that are maybe more subjective. And then hopefully some of that piece will come out as well. Maybe it is being with mentors in a supportive environment that has more of an impact. So we're hoping to be able to tease those two things out. But as it stands, that's one of those questions that we hope to answer.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm speaking with Jade Oldfield, who's involved with the Chess for Life program at the University of Lethbridge in Alberta. Youth in the province's criminal justice system can be referred to Chess for Life, which sees them spend 25 hours studying the game and learning to apply its lessons to life beyond the board. How much progress can someone make in 25 hours over the course of the program in terms of their ability and understanding of the game of chess?
Now that's a great question. I have to say we don't measure ELO ratings or anything, so I couldn't tell you that, you know, we have a kid that comes to us at, you know, 1,000 level rating and walks out at, you know, a grandmaster level by any means. However, we can definitely see that by playing with them, right? Because we have volunteers and mentors and research assistants where we're engaging with the kids, you get to feel out their playing style. So you really do notice an improvement in those key principles and tactics I referred to earlier. So we talked to the kids first about, you know, controlling the center of the board, developing pieces off the start, and trying to avoid moving pieces more than once when you're opening your game. And you can see them catch on to those principles very quickly. And that in and of itself takes you from being able to, let's say, do a scholar's mate on them and, you know, checkmate them in 4 moves to them recognizing those patterns. So the development of the principles and those key tactics comes pretty quickly. And then outside of that, like I said, we don't measure ELO or anything like that. But for some participants, the growth really just comes in even initiating the games. So we'll have some participants that are more hesitant to engage with volunteers or other youth. And as a result, what we do is we really just work with them individually to try and build those skills too. And even then, we can relate that process to what's happening over the board, right? Like when you think about those principles I talked about, opening principles of a chess game, how do those apply to everyday life? How do those apply to meeting somebody new? How do those apply to being in an uncomfortable situation? And so we try to bring those pieces of development along with the game.
What are the challenges that maybe accompany running the program?
You know, I think one of the biggest challenges we have tends to be things like transiency. Transiency not only in people coming and going and moving in and out of the city that we live in, but also just coming and going from the program. So what we've seen before is we get youth that have to serve any number of community service hours. So it can be anywhere from, let's say, 8 all the way up to 80. So obviously with Chess for Life, with 2 hours a week, for 8 hours, we only see them for a few weeks necessarily. And then in that sense, that also makes it challenging to conduct the research, because we are hoping when we're doing the pre and the post testing that we're looking for around, you know, anywhere from that 15 to 25 hours. 20 to 25 hours is kind of the gold standard, just according to the literature. But we're hoping to collect pretty much anything we can, because we do have participants that are only here with us for a short time. And then outside of like the transiency in terms of like hours, you know, 8 hours here, 10 hours there, we have participants that, you know, their families do move around. And so we might see them for a few months and then they're gone, and maybe they'll be back, maybe they won't.
I'm also wondering what your journey with the game of chess has been.
I have to say, I leave the chess instruction to Dr. Lance Grigg and some of my research assistants and volunteers that are a little more capable than myself. But I've really, if my skills haven't developed, my love of the game really has. Because it's just so complex, and the ideas behind some of the puzzles, behind some of the strategies just give me something new to learn every day. We were just working with our group at the Lethbridge Correctional Center last week, and as a result of that, we were looking at a puzzle, and this puzzle was so simple but so complex all at the same time, and there's just a lot of beauty in those moments where you just absolutely do not know what you're doing. And I think that's really where my development with the game has gone. I do not profess to be very successful. I definitely need to continue to work on my inhibition when it comes to looking before you leap. But that's also something that's wonderful about working with the youth in the program, is because you can come to it at a similar level and from a similar perspective from them, or as they do. And I have volunteers all the time that ask to get involved with the program, but they say, I'm sorry, I don't know how to play. And that's perfect, because not only can you learn with the kids, better yet, the kids can even teach you. And again, kind of bring that leadership perspective back to the program.
If you could scale this up infinitely, if someone came to Chess for Life and said, here is a blank check, What would the impact be? What kinds of things would you do?
Now that would be amazing. And that's where we're really not restricted at this point, but that's where we are really trying to focus, is like, where and how can we have the greatest amount of good? And so what I would like to see, if, you know, money wasn't an option or money wasn't an issue, is the ability to bring the program as it stands. So continue working with youth that have been involved with the correctional center or correctional system, but also open it to the community. So there's obvious hoops and some barriers you would have to jump through that I'm always thinking through. But again, bringing those two pieces together, because there's, at least in our local community, there is a big demand for chess programming and chess activities with youth. And so being able to bring those two worlds together, providing positive experiences for the youth that maybe haven't had them before, and then building out the research program there as well would be wonderful. But ultimately, it would be great to be able to create and develop our curriculum a little bit further so that we might be able to better support organizations that are looking to start programming. Because we know that we're not necessarily able to be everywhere and be everything all at once. However, if we could really provide that launch point for other organizations, I think that that would be really powerful as well, because we get requests on the weekly to develop something or to support someone. And just due to the nonprofit nature and the volunteer nature of everything, it's not feasible at this time, right? But I think just the support and building out what we have and really being able to strengthen the research component to really show why this is so successful would be absolutely amazing.
Now, if I understand correctly, the origin story of Chess for Life is that in Alberta, a number of years ago, a judge, as an alternative sentencing measure, sentenced a youth to go play basketball for a number of hours every week. And then Lance Grigg, the founder of Chess for Life, went up to him and said, hey, if you're willing to try basketball as an alternative sentence, how about chess? Here's reason X, Y, and Z why it would be a great idea. And the judge essentially said, okay, and it led to this program. Is that the story? And what kind of lessons do you think it has to tell everyone more broadly about, I don't know, like the justice system and alternative interventions?
Absolutely. So I can't speak to the exact details. However, it did happen exactly along those lines, in the sense that Dr. Grigg came across this situation and went, if this is an option, why can't we use chess, which is more cognitive, which is, we can connect more to real life. Sorry, basketball fans. But we can really use this as a tool to help promote, you know, positive life choices, critical thinking. Why can't this be an option? And so there was a little bit more digging in terms of, you know, collecting the research on chess and presenting that in order for this to be accepted. But then it was successfully added as an alternative sentencing measure to the Alberta Justice framework, essentially.
Well, if that's the story, what do you think? I don't know. What do you think is the lesson that anyone who's not necessarily related to chess or to basketball, like, what do you think is the lesson more broadly about the justice system and alternative interventions?
Really, we need to think differently in some of these situations, and especially in situations where youth are sentenced for maybe the first or second time. We can take a restorative justice approach to look at why they even landed there in the first place. And by looking at ways to address those gaps and providing programming that meets them where they're at, I think that we can look at making a difference in essentially how things progress. We know that punitive measures don't always work. We know that our youth justice system is struggling. It's overburdened. Like many systems nowadays. But if we can provide an alternative that shows youth that they are not the sum of their actions, and if we can provide youth an option that treats them like a human that has every ability to learn, that has the ability to improve both in a game of chess as well as in real life, that can make a real difference. And so talking about, you know, do we see development and do we see improvement in these youth? The answer is yes. And then what's even more powerful is when they can realize that if I can get better at this, I can get better at other things too. And that there isn't a limit that's placed on them when they come to see us, and that those limits don't exist outside of that program either.
Near the beginning of our conversation, you said that anecdotally, a lot of people have gone through this program and they've really made strides. Are there any stories that you can tell me?
One off the top of my head, we had a youth that was coming to us for months consistently. I think that he stayed with us well beyond his community service hours. He recently turned 18 and had, I believe, as far as I know, had actually gone and enrolled in the local college. And so that was one that was really kind of powerful for us too, is just making sure and being able to kind of connect him to those resources. In the past, before I joined the program, similar situations where Dr. Greg was actually able to kind of take the youth and walk them down to the registrar's office in the university where we're housed and kind of explain to him what the process was. And by the next week, he was registered. And then the week after, Dr. Greg walked him back down and helped him choose his courses, right? So these aren't the everyday situations, but they really are the ones that make you realize that this program can have an impact and does have an impact. And really just seeing the interactions between the volunteers and the youth. We brought on a new volunteer a little while ago, and his first day with us, he was able to connect with a youth that was normally very reserved, very withdrawn, very kept, you know, keeps to himself. And they were having discussions about every aspect of life. And I had never seen that youth speak more than five words in a 2-hour period. So it really kind of highlights that individual approach and that individual impact that people can have. The unfortunate thing is, because they are youth and because they are involved with the justice system, we're not able to really follow them, at least not at this point. And so most of the stories I get to tell that are really exciting are the ones that have kept in touch with us more than the other way around. But just, yeah, some of the quotes and some of the pieces that have been shared by the youth themselves can be really powerful.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation mm-hmm. about Chess for Life?
That's a great question. If there's billionaires out there listening, I am definitely open to funding for the program and for research. But outside of that, really, I would just say that the passion and the people that are involved with the program really do make a difference. And that goes not only for our kind of core program, but there are people across Alberta that we've been working with in youth correctional centers as well as in adult correctional centers that are just really passionate and really committed to trying to make a difference through this type of programming. And they are some of the most amazing people that I've ever met. And really, none of the programs that I've worked with or that are trying to get started or that have approached us for support would be where they are without those amazing people that really do look at restorative justice and justice in general from a different lens and hope to make a difference in the world of whatever population it is that they're working with.
Jade, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thanks for having us on.
Jade Oldfield works with Chess for Life, a restorative justice program at the University of Lethbridge that sees youth involved in the criminal justice system study the game of chess and apply its lessons to life.
People First Radio, People First Media, and People First Stories are community media projects of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and are produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast, podcast, and social media partners.